Mendelssohn is playing against the idea of improvised openings in classical music, because when you played a piano concerto in the 18th and early 19th century, you didn't just play the concerto. Czerny, Beethoven's pupil, tells you what you did. He advised the young pianist. He said, you come in, he said, you take your bow, you sit down at the piano in front of the orchestra, you take off your gloves and your top hat, okay, and you put them down beside the piano. Okay, he said, you then improvise a few bars to check, test the piano is working, you know, because they broke older pianos. And he said, then you take out your white handkerchief and wave it to the conductor to show that you're ready. Now, Beethoven imitated this in the fourth concerto in that he wrote in this improvised prelude. So you start the concerto, and this is very, was very unusual, with just the piano before the orchestra comes in, and this is what he wrote. And this is, as we know, the beginning of the fourth. The piano opening, and it's the improvisation is designed to set the key, which in this case is this key, G. Okay, but the joke in Beethoven is that the orchestra then comes in the wrong key. As if the piano's preluded in the wrong key. So the piano's gone. And then you'd expect the orchestra to come in with. But instead we get. That's the orchestra. Wrong key, it's in B. And then it spends the next 8 bars trying to get back to the right key. Nearly there. And we're now, and that's suddenly back in this other. So that's really the joke here, and it's based on improvisation, the opening. Now, there's a similar joke in the fifth concerto, the next one done differently, and the joke in the next one is that the improvised prelude is shared between piano and orchestra. So what would normally have happened is the pianist would come in, play his prelude. Let's supposing it's the prelude at the opening of the fifth, and it would be something like this. Prelude in the key. But the joke in the fifth is that the orchestra plays a chord to start off, which they shouldn't be doing, and then suddenly the piano comes in with his prelude. Because that's the orchestra as well. So they're sharing this thing, it ought to be solo. So Mendelssohn is following on to this, and he's trying to work out, how do I do this, but do it differently again? And he has a very brilliant idea, and that is that the orchestra plays the prelude in the key, not the piano. So at the beginning of Mendelssohn's concerto, you'll just hear these few bars in the orchestra in G minor. That's it. Now, of course, it just stops there, but it just stops because, in fact, the piano then takes over from the end of the orchestra's phrase. And the beginning of the piano's first phrase is the end of the orchestra's phrase. And it's a complete surprise because you're not expecting the orchestra to stop there and not expecting the piano to come in there. So I'll play the two together, orchestra. Okay, so that's the first surprise. And then the next surprise is that the piano goes on for another page. Here's the piano still going on. But this time you're wondering what on earth is going on, but then suddenly he cadences. And now now the orchestra comes in, finally, after two pages.
Thank you. Judith, just listening to that, I wonder what you think when you listen to this concerto. What you think about Mendelssohn the performer? What does this tell us about him as a pianist?
Well, he was a wonderful pianist, and thank you very much, Ken. He just seems to enjoy the instrument, enjoys writing for the instrument, enjoys playing these, what you might call jokes. I don't think it's a joke in Beethoven. I think Beethoven was dead serious in what he was doing.
It's wit rather than joke.
But it's the wit. Serious Germanic wit. Yeah. Whereas Mendelssohn is very lighthearted. I think he's just... he was supposed to be a wonderful gymnast. They had equipment in the big garden in their house in Berlin. And I think of this as his... as the concerto goes on, as if he's exercising his wonderful gymnastic ability, but in music, that is, trying new leaps, new cartwheels, whatever it might be, with tremendous enjoyment, and at the same time, with a wonderful sense of before, during, and after. That is the structure of the whole thing.
Do you get a sense of the sort of pianist that he was playing his music?
Yes, restricted. I mean, Liszt said of Mendelssohn that he had more warm than Sigismund Thalberg, who was Liszt's great rival as virtuoso, but less techniques, said Liszt. And the piano writing is actually almost 18th century, or late 18th century, in the sense that it doesn't do any of the very wide stretches. Most of the passage work is sort of single notes. Just one quick example. Here's a scale passage from the Mendelssohn, and I'll play the way Mendelssohn writes it, and then the way I think Liszt would have written it 6 years later. Just after the bit that I played there, you then get the piano then plays this. And there's many passages like that, but 5 years later, that would usually be done in octaves like this. Etc., etc. So you've got the... So you get a much, much heavier effect, you know. And Liszt developed passage work like that, where you would do everything in interlinking octaves. Like that. So within a few years of Mendelssohn, what Mendelssohn is doing there is borderline pretty old-fashioned writing, and he knows it, because he quite deliberately, he tells his friend Ferdinand Hiller, he doesn't want to do all this modern stuff, he says, because, you know, the music won't be any better, it'll just be flashy and showy. So he's trying deliberately to be conservative here.
And what about the performers who followed, the great romantics? I mean, Horowitz was described as the last romantic. What was it about their style of playing which defined them as romantics?
Well, this is the interesting thing. Their style of playing was almost completely anti-Mendelssohnian. I mean, the style of Liszt, Rachmaninoff, Hans von Bülow, Busoni, Josef Hoffmann. I mean, Busoni thought that Mendelssohn was just sort of parlor, drawing room pianistics, effectively. When Mendelssohn was played, a lot of the time it was rewritten. In terms of composition, there's a massive amount of Mendelssohn in Sullivan, in the Gilbert and Sullivan operettas, that are unthinkable without Mendelssohn. Elgar, too, huge amount of Mendelssohn in Elgar, including details of scoring, etc., etc. Oddly enough, a fair amount of Mendelssohn in Wagner, even though he wouldn't have liked me to be saying this. I mean, the Hebrides overture especially, and sort of fairy music, the fairy style in Tannhäuser, for example, is very Mendelssohnian. So this comes out much later, but Mendelssohn is really, shall we say, the last of the brilliant style in that sense, but done in a wonderfully refined and creative way.
I should mention, though, that Mendelssohn was the one who kept performing the Beethoven concerti.
So he was an exception there,
and Liszt did too.
Yes, Liszt did too.
And I think Mendelssohn performed one of the Chopin, the F minor concerto of Chopin. So I think his influence was not just through his own music, but in the programming he did at the various festivals which he conducted. He didn't consider the terms classical and romantic or Baroque in the way we do now, as defining different stages of. It was all one to him, and he drew on Bach, he drew on Mozart and Beethoven in the same way. They were like his companions in music. So I think it was a very different kind of ethos.
There we must leave it. Kenneth Hamilton and Judith Chenik, thank you very much.
Ian Skelly hosted that Proms Plus event, recorded early today down the steps from the hall at the Royal College of Music. The producer was Janet Tappan. And during the BBC Proms 2013 season, there's a pre-concert event every day at the RCM. Tomorrow's Proms Plus, for example, explores the relationship between Benjamin Britten's music and the poetry and novels which inspired it. It's well worth having a look online or in the brochure to see what's happening before any prom you might be coming to. Well, as the promenaders tell us how many thousands of pounds they've gathered for musicians' charities, musical charities, it's always such a fantastic sum every year. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, where in this evening's first prom, live of course here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, the Scottish Chamber Orchestra is playing under its principal conductor, Robin Ticciati. The main work in this second part of the concert is Beethoven's Third Symphony, the Eroica, but before it we have Bach, a canon and fugue from his compendium called The Art of Fugue. I asked Robin Ticciati how the interplay of musical lines, the counterpoint of the Baroque period, fitted into the scheme of things tonight.
I was just looking at a way of finding something before the Eroica, and then this idea of counterpoint, and after the death, or whatever chaos you want to program onto the second movement of the Eroica, how he looks forward, how he breaks through that. And it's the joy of counterpoint. And somehow the idea of just bringing that to the audience's attention orally, but in a different guise, and to use George Benjamin's fascinating orchestration. I mean, in the canon, he splits the theme between three violins in voice one, and then two violas and one cello in voice two. And even the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-dum-bum-bum, it'll be da-da-dum, violin one. Da-da-dum, violin two. So it's always going between the instruments. Who would have thought that a harmonic and a high flute and a low second horn could sound like a chamber organ, but the most sci-fi chamber organ that there is. It's really fascinating. So in this space, it's beautiful because it's intimate and yet it really focuses the ears. And I think that's what I wanted to try and do before the Eroica.
Robin Ticciati. The nine players for the Bach on stage in a horseshoe. Three violins, two violas, a cello, two horns and a flute. The flute only appears in the fugue. And here comes Robin Ticciati returning to the Albert Hall platform to conduct with members of the Scottish Chamber Orchestra in George Benjamin's arrangement of a canon fugue from Bach's The Art of Fugue. Thank you. Magical sounds created by George Benjamin in his orchestration of A Canon at the Octave and Contrapuntus Fugue 7 from Bach's The Art of Fugue, performed to open the second half of their prom by members of the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Robin Ficciati. Florent Dondera, Ruth Crouch, Heather Badker, violins, Jane Atkins, Duncan Ferguson, violas, David Watkin, cello, Alison Mitchell, flute, Jocelyn Lightfoot and Harry Johnston, horns. Benjamin made his arrangements to open a concert in Paris in 2007, which was alternating Bach with Boulez. So now the rest of the Scottish Chamber Orchestra returns to applause to the Royal Albert Hall stage to perform Beethoven's Eroica Symphony. When he was writing it in 1803, the man with whom he most associated greatness was Napoleon Bonaparte, who seemed to embody the republican ideals of many of Europe's intellectuals. But then, when Napoleon crowned himself emperor, Beethoven angrily deleted his name as the symphony's dedicatee from the title page of the score. The symphony emerged from personal despair. Beethoven's spiritual rebirth is mirrored in his heroic journey through the four movements of the symphony. The first, the colossal struggle, the second, a tragic funeral march, the third, a joyous renewal of life, and the last, a triumphant affirmation of the power of man, with a dance-like tune Beethoven borrowed from his music for the ballet The Creatures of Prometheus. The whole is music that seems to have set the precedent for the way composers would write symphonies over the next 100 years and more. I asked Robin Ticciarti whether he thought the Eroica was a completely new kind of symphony.
Where I personally am with it at the moment is this bridge between the classical and the romantic, and how the fortepianos, how the sempre fortes, how that is all impinging on the way we play it and listen to it, and finding that palette, finding that drama, and therefore hopefully finding the revolution in it, and the angst. It's not all beautiful. It's a challenge, but what a tome.
And what differences when you play the Eroica with a chamber orchestra to when you, say, do it with...
Well, look, we have natural horns, natural timpani. When I say natural timpani, calf head timps and natural trumpets. And so already there's a different type of drama going on there. They can be blazing in fortissimo, and the strings can still be heard. And at times it's dirty, and you need that. You've got to feel the mud and the grit going through that second movement. And also the idea that so much of the shapes, I suppose you could call them sentences or phrases in this music, it's rhetoric, it's speaking. And chamber musicians speak melodies. Of course, so do symphonic orchestras, but somehow it's easier to negotiate the speed of a word, the speed of a phrase, when you've got 8 nimble violins on a certain bit of counterpoint. But the great thing is this music's for everyone.
Robin Ticciarti. Full Scottish Chamber Orchestra. On stage here in the Albert Hall. I should say the latest on the bassoon saga is that actually there's been a bit of inter-Scottish orchestra cooperation. It's the top half of the bassoon is from a member of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, put together with the principal player's own bottom half, as it were. Here is Robin Ticciarti to conduct Beethoven's Third Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
A broad grin of pride on the face of Robin Ticciotti at the end of that performance of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, Symphony No. 3, performed to end tonight's first prom here in the Albert Hall and live on Radio 3 by the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, led by Florian Donderer, conducted by Robin Ticciotti. Barely a year between the second symphony and that third. Everything's changed. Exponentially greater proportions, but Beethoven using them to express a concept far bigger than anything attempted before. Back comes Robin Ticciotti, bringing his Scottish Chamber Orchestra to its feet. Well, as I said earlier, they're taking this programme to San Sebastian in Spain next week. And in the new season, which next year they'll be celebrating their 40th anniversary of the Scottish Chamber Orchestra, Schumann cycle in November and December, Ligeti and Dvorak being paired. Ligeti Violin Concerto and Dvorak Symphonic Variations, a programme particularly appeals to me. And I shouldn't forget they're going back to the Edinburgh Festival this weekend. In fact, Beethoven's Prometheus music complete, very appropriate seeing as some of that appears in the Eroica Symphony. René Jacobs will be conducting that, touring with the Scottish Chamber Orchestra for the first time. As for Robin Ticciotti himself, well, he's looking forward to his Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra debut and particularly to return engagements with the London Symphony Orchestra and the Swedish Radio Symphony. Robin bringing the four horn players, playing on natural horns all evening. Apart actually from the George Benjamin, to their feet. And the entire wind section of the Scottish Chamber Orchestra. Matthew Hardy, the timpanist. And all the strings. Well, in the prom tomorrow at 7:30, the LSO was to have been conducted by Robin Ticciotti's mentor, Sir Colin Davis. And following his death, Daniel Harding is in charge of a programme of Elgar, Tippett and Britten with Ian Bostridge, the soloist in Les Illuminations. But we'll be back in this hall in an hour or so's time at 10:15 when another orchestra from north of the border, the BBC Scottish Symphony, is conducted by Ilan Volkov in music by four visionary, idiosyncratic composers, Morten Feldman, Gerald Barry, John White and Frederick Koshevsky, who's also the soloist in the world premiere of his piano concerto. Presenter Andrew McGregor tells me it's a Mozartian structure with a very different outcome. But as Robin Ticciotti returns to the platform and the Scottish Chamber Orchestra refuse to stand while he takes the applause, he can't believe it of them. And now they stand. And now for a bit of downtime, I'll hand you on to Jonathan Swain waiting for us in the studio at Broadcasting House. Jonathan.
Martin, thank you very much. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall, and talking about the time, the Eroica, well, it hardly ever fails in performance, does it? But never in a joyous and joyously illuminating performance like that one. Just to say there's a chance to hear that prom again here on BBC Radio 3 on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Also, if you want to listen to it when you want to listen to it, every prom is available to listen to online via the Radio 3 website, and that's any time you like for 7 days from the original broadcast. In the beginning was Sinning. That's the title of our feature in just under a quarter of an hour tonight. The Reverend Richard Coles with the first of three features on the idea of sin. That's at 9:30. And then, as Martin was saying, we're back at the Royal Albert Hall for the second of tonight's proms. Four Mavericks and two premieres. John White's Chord-Breaking Machine, Gerald Barry's No Other People, add to those two Americans, Frederick Koshevsky's Radio 3 commissioned piano concerto, which he's playing himself, and Morten Feldman's late masterpiece Coptic Light brings the prom to a beatific close. That's all from 10:15 this evening, live from the Royal Albert Hall here on BBC Radio 3. A little more about Koshevsky. He was Massachusetts born and he's now in his mid-70s. And he's a modern composer-performer. It's tempting to think the tradition of composer-pianist ended with Rachmaninoff. Among other things, there's Koshevsky's Variations on the People United Will Never Be Defeated, an hour-long piano epic from 1975 based on a Chilean freedom song that somehow manages to sound like a latter-day equivalent of the Beethoven Diabelli variations. Since People United, there have been other far longer Koshevsky epics, among them The Road, what he calls a novel for solo piano, lasting around 12 hours. Well, anyway, this is one of Shevsky's North American ballads, written in 1979 and giving political songs the Bach chorale treatment. Winsboro Cotton Mill Blues, it's called, and it uses a song about the working conditions in North Carolina's textile mills a century or so ago. And it opens with a hair-raising representation of the mechanical workings of the mill machines themselves. The pianist is Milton Schlosser.
Thank you.
hammering of the textile machines making a startling reappearance at the close there, only to disappear again. That is a powerful piece, isn't it? Winsboro Cotton Mill Blues, the last of the four North American ballads by the American Frederick Jevski, the ballads from the late 1970s. The pianist was Milton Schlosser. Jevski, a formidable pianist himself, one who's happy to venture where others fear to tread, into Cornelius Cardew or Stockhausen, for example. And as I mentioned, he's playing his own newly written piano concerto in tonight's Late Prom here on BBC Radio 3. The prom itself starting at 10:15. It's 9:30, and now on Radio 3, our feature, and we begin a second chance to hear a series of three programmes in which the Reverend Richard Coles explores the notions of vice and virtue across the world and across history in The Idea of Sin. This first programme is called In the Beginning Was Sinning.
If you were associating Padova or Padua with the sapphire blue skies and slanting sunshine of Italy, well, today it's actually wreathed in a fog. It's almost like a Padua peculiar, you could call it. So we step out boldly through the fog to the Scrovegni Chapel.
I'm in Padua in Italy, 30 miles or so to the west of Venice, not this morning glittering in sunlight, but obscured by freezing fog. Paduans, in effortlessly fashionable knitwear, are hurrying through winter-grey streets, seeking warmth. But I'm here to stand in front of the city's most famous fireside, and what a scorching, roasting fire it is.
And it's where, you might say, Giotto's greatest masterpiece, his most worked out vision of the whole scheme of salvation of humanity is found. Frescoes on the walls of a chapel that was built for a family that made its wealth in usury, the Scrovegni.
My companion, art historian Zuleika Murat, and I are here to see one of the most vivid and sobering depictions ever created of the consequences of sin.
Well, it's extraordinary. It's about the size of a chapel of an Oxbridge college, I suppose. Stalls to left and right, but really it's all about the frescoes. There's a barrel vault, and at the, I guess is that the, yes, that's the west end. You have a vision of Christ Pantocrator, Christ in glory, judge of all. So anyone who was visiting here would not simply be looking at the beauty of the painted image, would be being told something about the scheme of salvation, about what the ultimate destination of a Christian soul might be.
And you can see it in the Last Judgment.
That's the most vivid one, isn't it, which takes up almost the whole of the west wall. Yes.
So when people went out from the chapel, the Last Judgment was the last scene they saw.
So that would be the message that they left with, saying this is the ultimate fate.
Yes.
And it's an interesting, I mean, it's a very binary contrast, isn't it? It's divided squarely in two. We have Christ at the centre in a mandala as a sign of his glory. Christ as judge of all. And to his left, we have the souls at the bottom left, souls down to perdition. And Giotto leaves us in no doubt as to the terrible fate that awaits those who are damned. And yet to the right, there are the souls who are saved, who are ascending towards the heaven.
And there are also some symbolism. So, for example, the cycles of the vices and the virtues, which are depicted here, communicate some further meanings.
Consigned to the pit of hell, there are all kinds of figures. There's three men who are hanged, they're naked, and they're hanging from a branch of a tree, mirroring the hanging of Judas himself. There's a serpent that has wrapped itself, whilst Satan himself seems to be sitting on a serpent or a dragon. The dragon is eating head first some unfortunate. There are people hanging from their hair from a branch. There are people being thrown into pits. There are people being sort of pitchforked into the fire of hell itself. It's a ghastly, ghastly image of what becomes of the damn soul. Wherever there are human beings, wherever human beings contend, you will find sin, a falling short of the mark, wickedness, failing to discharge our duties, our responsibilities, well, call it what you will. And so we've come to Italy to explore some of the more vivid examples of that, so vividly captured, in fact, in Italian art of the medieval period and the Renaissance.
sin here has always been pretty relative.
David Willey, veteran BBC Rome correspondent.
If you can get absolution for sin, well, it's very nice for the conscience, and it enables you to renew yourself in a way perhaps we who were born in more northern austere climes and with more austere religious beliefs feel that this is Mediterranean license.
In a way, sin is a function of a broader human concept, which is understanding how humans had best live. That's really what we call ethics, what we call morality.
Dr. Jessica Fraser, lecturer in theology at the University of Kent.
And that's simply part of psychology. In a way, it's a natural outcome of having free will. Every day we have to make those decisions. And in that respect, every religion has to make sense of this. And every religion gives some sort of guidelines.
Do you think that sin can be good?
I deeply believe that God can bring great good out of sin, but I don't think we would ever want to say that sin in and of itself is good.
I suppose what I mean is that the way great sinners in art, for example, Don Giovanni, a sort of inextinguishable figure, well, until the end of the opera, that there is something about him that I think is deeply, deeply attractive.
No human individual, even sometimes the most wicked, is wicked from top to bottom. I think what we frequently find appealing about figures like Don Giovanni and the rest is their struggle between goodness and evil, and we can relate to their being drawn to evil.
Gary Anderson, professor of Catholic theology at Notre Dame University, Indiana. Like most people of my age and background, the idea of sin first came to me through the medium of Sunday school and will forever be associated with the ungenerous distribution of Smarties. Later, as a boy chorister, I came into contact with Christian theology and iconography, very rich on this topic. These provide the beginning for our exploration, over three programmes, of the ideas of sin and its penalties and its remedies in Catholic Christendom, so vividly encountered in the art and architecture of Italy, in the Reformation which followed, and in other religious systems that seek also to evaluate our behaviour and direct our doings in ways that are sometimes very similar and in others strikingly different. In the second and third programmes, we examine the various ways we're led into temptation and look at how we might be rescued from the consequences. But to begin with, what do we actually mean by sin?
Thank you very much indeed. Tonight's sin. The point is really that it's no longer easy to define what sin is at all. The absolutes have gone. I mean, Bertrand Russell said, sin is geographical. And there's something in that. I mean, in Samoa, for instance, it's a sin to remove the straws from a pierced coconut while a guest is present. It's a pretty disgraceful thing to do in Surbiton, too, but...
David Frost, a child of the manse, as it happens, in 1966. The word sin is first found in English in the 9th century, and according to the Oxford English Dictionary, probably has roots in the Latin word sons, meaning guilty. The definition offered, however, is admirably clear. An act which is regarded as a transgression of the divine law and an offence against God. A violation, especially willful or deliberate, of some religious or moral principle. So much for the dictionary. But what does it actually mean to people? It's a question I put to a number of specialists in religion, ethics and psychology. First, here are Gary Anderson, author of Sin, a History, and first, Janet Soskis, Professor of Philosophical Theology at the University of Cambridge.
Well, I think sin has to be distinguished from something like guilt. You know, guilt seems to me to be an emotion or a mood. You can feel guilty about all kinds of things. You can feel guilty about missing a Weight Watchers meeting. And you could feel guilty if you're a member of a terrorist group for not setting off your bomb. You know, so guilt is not necessarily tied up with being actually guilty, although we use that language too. But sin, I think, in its classical anchorage, which is mostly within Judaism and Christianity, is a state of being in alienation from God. And you may or may not feel guilty about that at all. It's a kind of disorder that affects the whole of your lives and the whole of the lives of other people. But I think where it comes into the English language initially is from this religious register, and then it gets widened out to speak about other things.
Gary, when does the term, or what we would understand as the term sin, first appear?
I believe the first time we see the word used is in the story of Cain and Abel. Of course, for scholars of the Old Testament per se, the term for sin is there from the very beginning.
So it's absolutely fundamental to Jewish tradition.
Completely fundamental to the biblical tradition in general.
And when it first appears, is it clear what it means or is it ambiguous?
It's clear, but it's susceptible to a variety of different permutations, we might want to say. The primary means of understanding sin in the Old Testament is that of a burden that individuals bear on their back. It's not the only version, but it is the primary version throughout most of the Old Testament.
At what point does it start to become perhaps recognizable to someone on the other side of the Judeo-Christian tradition, such as we are, to mean something to do with wrongdoing?
Well, it always means wrongdoing, but the thing about the Bible is that sin is always understood in a richly metaphoric sense. So it's very easy or common in everyday speech to speak of people laboring under a certain burden, and one can, of course, graphically illustrate this in a cartoon, as often happens, with a man with slumped shoulders and maybe a cloud over his head. And that kind of picture, verbal picture or actual visual picture, is the type of thing one finds in the Bible from cover to cover.
But I think originally it suggests a sense of alienation from an order that is cosmic. So within Christianity and Judaism, that was an order established by God, a creator God. But you could see that in ancient Greece, there was a sense amongst many of the philosophers that there was an order to the cosmos. And the object of a good philosophy education was to order yourself towards the proper harmony of the cosmos, to be in order. Now, they wouldn't have called that sin, but that kind of concept gets married in the early days of Christianity to the idea of being alienated from the God who is the source of this order. And that's where I think the central line comes. That being said, obviously, there's many different cultures and traditions around the world, apart from ancient Greece, would have this idea of an order in which ideally you should orient your lives. Your lives will be better because that's somehow the way you're made to be.
Researching outside of the Judeo-Christian Islamic world, you very quickly start to think about what morality means in radically different cultures.
Dr. Jessica Fraser is lecturer in theology at the University of Kent.
And for me, it's been interesting to see how ethics, how essentially good human behaviour, kindness, compassion, arise in cultures that don't have a concept of sin. That, to me, is what's most striking. Whereas in the West, we see sin as a fundamental concept that kind of underpins the idea that we will behave well around other humans. Other cultures manage to behave really fairly well without this concept of sin even existing anywhere in their cultural sphere. What you get in many cultures is not so much sin in the terms that we understand it in the West, of a kind of a polar opposition between all that is bad and all that is good, intrinsically bad and intrinsically good. Rather, you get a sense of what is right or what is wrong to do under the circumstances. So in India, there's a notion called dharma. People have heard of dharma in many cases, and really it means what is proper and fitting to do. But of course, as we know, what's fitting is different for different people at different times. It's bad to kill, always bad to kill, unless you're defending your children from an invading army. It's always bad to be harsh to your children, unless they really do need to do their homework. So the notion that there's an absolute right and an absolute wrong is really not something that that Asia buys into on a wider scale. One example outside of the Indian world, if you look on a wider scale throughout Asia and the Americas, you find a large number of religions that don't believe in a particular deity and don't really believe in dharma either. You find many religions who believe in spirits. And those spirits don't tell them, you know, this is what is right and this is what is wrong. But what those spirits do is watch how you act. And if you're mean to the spirits, they will get you back. So in a sense, those cultures naturally enact morality. So just as you take care of the spirits, you take care of your family, and your grandparents, once they die, become spirit members of your community who need the same care and love as any other human being.
Sin, in a narrow sense, is of course a Judeo-Christian concept, yet the impulse to transgress and the need to right wrongs seem to be rooted very deeply in our psychology.
children first learn their moral and ethical values according to what the parents model, on the one hand, so they copy the parents, but also what the parents reward and punish. But as you develop your morality, it becomes more and more internalized. And in fact, then, as you move up to the higher levels of moral reasoning, you may think, actually, some of what I learnt about was immoral. So, for example, you might think, you know, I was taught that you should always defend your country, no matter how much violence you needed to do that. But with a higher moral code, you might think, I'm not sure about that, actually.
Dr. Paul Gilbert, Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Derby.
When you're into shame heavily of authority and punishment,